U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration. The new president has taken a decidedly different stance on some of the nation's long-standing foreign policy objectives and has also employed a different style in carrying it out. The early days of the administration have been marked by turmoil, with the quick departure of National Security Advisor Mike Flynn and the cloud of questions surrounding past communications between officials of the administration, the Trump campaign, and the Russian government. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with former Ambassador Larry Pope and Barbara Elias Klenner, who teaches U.S. foreign policy and national security at Bowdoin College, about the challenges facing the administration as it sets its foreign policy course. The new face of U.S. diplomacy. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to shake things up in Washington. He appears to be doing just that. He also appears to be shaking things up on the international scene. In less than a month into his administration, Trump has put a man with no government foreign policy experience in charge of the State Department and has yet to put a national security advisor in place. Today, we're going to talk about diplomacy and international affairs in the age of Trump. With me in the studio, Barbara Elias Klenner. She teaches U.S. foreign policy and national security at Bowdoin College, where she is an assistant professor of government. And Larry Pope is also with us. He's a former ambassador to Chad, political advisor to General Anthony Zinni in Central Command, and charge d'affaires in Tripoli, Libya. He retired from the U.S. Foreign Service after 31 years. And as always, we want to hear from you. What international hotspot do you think the president and his administration should be focused on? The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today. It's pretty clear, I think we know, that the Trump administration has taken a new tack on a number of fronts here in the issue of foreign policy. And I thought we would start the discussion looking at not only the substance of the policy with respect to our allies and other nations, but also the style in which this is being carried out. And so we'll play a clip. This is from yesterday's press conference in which President Trump is talking about the administration's potential relationship with Russia and then makes a reference in this to a Russian intelligence ship that has been in international waters off the east coast of the U.S.
If we could get along with Russia, that's a positive thing. We have a very talented man, Rex Tillerson, who's going to be meeting with them shortly. And I told him, I said, I know politically it's probably good for me. Hey, the greatest thing I could do is shoot that ship that's 30 miles offshore right out of the water. Everyone in this country is going to say, oh, it's so great. That's great. That's not great. I would love to be able to get along with Russia. Now, you've had a lot of presidents that haven't taken that tack. Look where we are now. Look where we are now.
All right. There are a few things to chew on there. Larry, we'll start with you. Sure. What about this language used here about, blasting the ship out of the water? That is not something that you would normally hear a world leader use in this context.
No. As you noted, Keith, it's in international waters. Right? So that would be an act of war, an unprovoked act of war. You can argue that the Russians shouldn't have that ship out there off our coast, but they have a perfect right to do that. And the United States is perhaps we are the world power that benefits the most from freedom of navigation in around the world in international waters. So that's a right that's sacred to us that we would defend. And this sort of casual comment about attacking somebody reflects the fact, I think, that, this isn't reality TV anymore. This is reality. And our president has failed to make the transition from one to the other. Watching that press conference yesterday, I had the feeling that we were passengers in an airplane and there was nobody at the controls. And it's a very disquieting sense.
Barbara Elias Klenner, what was your take, I guess, on anything about that clip and that press conference?
Well, I think that it reflects President Trump's emphasis on embracing uncertainty. And to echo the words of the ambassador as well, that he has this emphasis on the media and on ratings and on what would play well to an audience. But you're not trying to entertain an audience. You are the guardian of U.S. national security and on an existing world order. And so that's an entirely different mandate than what he's speaking to in that clip when he says, oh, it would be great. It would be great. How? It would be great in terms of, again, getting people to tune in, but would that make the United States better off? I don't think anyone would argue that.
And when you say embracing uncertainty as a are you suggesting it's an intentional strategy, or that's just the effect it's having? He's uncertain.
I think both. I think he has over and over again talked about the fact that he wants to, as a nation, be more unpredictable. I mean, those are I'm paraphrasing his words there, but essentially of trying to embrace uncertainty. But I think that there is a big difference between unpredictability and instability. And so he's very much playing on that line. And it's difficult in terms of foreign policy to understand what is he doing.
We didn't, Larry, hear a lot about foreign policy over the course of the campaign. It was kind of there were other things being discussed mostly every day. He would mention, ISIS and that he would have a plan. But oftentimes when pressed on foreign policy positions, he would say, well, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want to give away my strategy. Mm-hmm. That would be irresponsible. So we didn't have a lot to go on. What did we know, I guess, coming in?
Well, one thing we knew, of course, was that he intended to he admired Vladimir Putin, the authoritarian leader of Russia. And it sounds as though he admired him because they see the world in similar terms, as a power struggle for dominance. And that's profoundly worrying. That's not the United States.
Where is that coming from, though? Do we know? I guess this is all some information might be revealed in the course of this investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee about who was talking to whom and why, and this role of the Russians in the election. It's all very murky. But do we have a sense of, to either of you, where this kind of interest in resetting with Russia is coming from? Is that something that past presidents have also tried to do?
There's nothing wrong with attempting to, work productively with Russia in areas where we have agreements. But the Russians have behaved in an appallingly sort of genocidal way, I would say, in Syria. So the idea that we would make common cause with them to defeat ISIS would put us on the wrong side of that conflict. The Russians have grabbed Crimea and they've threatened Ukraine, and sanctions have been adopted by the European Union and the United States in order to prevent that. So you start from there. Sanctions are in place for good reasons. So it's a strange business, I think. And as you suggest, Keith, we don't really understand what's going on. At least I don't. Mike Flynn has just been fired for contacts with the Russian ambassador in the period before the election. The president says that these were real leaks but fake news, which doesn't make any sense at all. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence is going to be investigating for its part. Both of our main senators are on the Senate Select Committee. So we'll see where it goes. I think there are probably a few more things to come out of that closet before this is over.
And I would also add to that the Republicans, or many Republicans, are themselves flummoxed by Trump's affinity towards the Russians. And I think that that's been creating tension within that party and kind of illustrates how Trump himself is an iconoclast, not only within American politics, but also very much within the Republican Party. I think there is a big puzzle there, too, the affinity towards the Russians and in particular Vladimir Putin. that are causing a good deal of distress within the Republican Party as well.
I've been reading some analysis preparing for this show of some observers saying that the Russians, this relationship, this young relationship, might be headed south. That the respect for the Trump administration is, if there was some on the part of the Russians, is disappearing. Hard to gauge, I guess, but good to speculate. On another major sticky and long complicated foreign policy front for the U.S. is Israel. And while we historically, of course, have been this very strong ally, there is this tightrope to be walked about the settlements and what to do about the Palestinians. So I want to play also, this is a clip from this week when Prime Minister Netanyahu is visiting and President Trump is asked about the two-state solution.
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best. As far as the embassy moving to Jerusalem, I'd love to see that happen. We're looking at it very, very strongly. We're looking at it with great care, believe me.
All right. Larry Pope, I'll let you dissect that in terms of substance and style.
What two states means, what a two-state solution means, is a state for the Palestinians so that they have a measure of autonomy and aren't ruled over by Israel in perpetuity, particularly as soon they will constitute a majority of the population of Palestine. So to turn your back on that means to endorse continued Israeli rule over a restive majority within Palestine, and it's a formula for instability in the region, and it's a formula for, I would argue, jeopardizing Israel's democratic character. So to casually sort of suggest that one state, two state doesn't really matter, suggests I'm not sure he understood what he was saying. I really am not. He said it so casually and in such an offhand manner that one wonders whether he really understands what he's saying.
Yeah. Barbara?
Right, and the idea that he says, well, I like the one that both parties like. Well, if there was such a thing, we would be done with this a long time ago.
So it's a non-answer, really. Yeah.
Right. So what does that mean? I mean, I think it speaks to his penchant for seeing international affairs as deal-making.
Yes.
And it's like, well, let's come up with a deal that both of these parties can agree with. But when you're talking about something as entrenched as the Israeli-Palestinian question, you're talking about compromise that would be deeply upsetting to both sides. And it's neither side like the deal that mm-hmm. they get if they are actually able to come to any sort of agreement. So I agree with the ambassador that there is a question here about this is not just a question of keeping them guessing by being ambiguous. This is betraying what seems like ignorance.
If we talk about a one-state solution that both sides agree with, we would be assuming that the Palestinians will acquiesce in Israeli rule over them without democratic rights for them in perpetuity. That's not a deal. That's not a possible deal. So for him to suggest that really raises the question of whether he understands the situation.
He did has made a sort of statement about where he stands, at least if you look at his choice for ambassador to Israel, who is this David Friedman, who is a hardliner supporter, funder of Israeli settlements. There's no question about where he stands.
Yes.
Would that suggest that that's also Trump's position?
Well, David Friedman was his bankruptcy lawyer and he had a few bankruptcies, so David had a good deal of work, and presumably they worked closely together over the years. This whole it's confusing. David Friedman, during his confirmation hearings, walked back a number of the things that he's believed for many years in an effort to get confirmation. Nikki Haley, the ambassador at the UN, has said that the United States continues to support a two-state solution in Palestine. So where the administration is open to question. You know, if I were at an embassy overseas and trying to figure out what to say to a government that I was accredited to, I wouldn't have the slightest idea what to say to them at this point about where the United States stands on the Middle East.
Is it fair? Is it could you sum it up, though, as America first? That is, if there's a theme here, it's we're looking out for our own. But then again, isn't that traditionally what foreign policy has been for most nations?
Right. Well, that's exactly the thing. I think when he came out with that slogan, America First, that it was capturing this spirit of possibility, the shaking things up. The reason why a lot of people ended up supporting him was that there was something outside of Washington. But for those of us in foreign affairs, and the ambassador can speak to this as well, American foreign policy always puts American interests first and foremost. You know, so it was a little bit of a confusing idea in terms of what exactly does that mean? Because there's an implicit message in America First that there was a betrayal of that priority in earlier eras that, you know, that's not really fair to those like the ambassador who have worked in the national security apparatus defending U.S. interests for that long. And so what I fear is that America First, that the president actually may mean putting American short-term interests ahead of other long-term priorities like American values. And that's what you know, I think we're looking at a month into this administration. What exactly is foreign policy going to do? And what does that mean in terms of balancing short-term versus long-term priorities for the United States?
You know, do you think we'll also see are there signs of a shifting away from career folks in the State Department and moving some of that decision making and planning and strategizing to, you know, his son-in-law Jared Kushner or whoever else happens to be in his tight group?
We should talk a little bit about that and the institutions of our national security. Let's see. It's hard to know exactly where to start, but the firing of Mike Flynn left the White House rudderless with regard to the conduct of our national security. It might be useful to talk a little bit about what the National Security Council is and what it does, because it's frequently confused in the press, and I think it's confusing to a lot of people. We use the term National Security Council in two senses. One is the 1947 Act, which created the National Security Council, which provides for the president and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Treasury, other cabinet officers, as the sort of directing the board of directors, if you will, for American foreign policy, in which the president is the chairman. The other sense in which we use that term, however, is the staff of the National Security Advisor. Right, the National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, until recently, the post is now vacant, has 400 or 500 people. That's the current total working for him. And so the shorthand for that is National Security Council. They're mostly career government folks with an overlay of political appointees in the senior directors. That whole institution at the White House, which has grown very powerful over the last 20 years or so, and particularly during the Obama years, is completely leaderless at this point. The State Department has no political appointees, with the exception of the Secretary. So there's no one there to make that machinery work. The Defense Department has Secretary Mattis is there, but nobody else is there. He's home alone. There's nobody else in the Defense Department from the Trump administration. The Deputy Secretary of Defense is acting from the Obama administration still. So the machinery of government is simply not working here. And we had an extraordinary statement the other day from a general named Tony Thomas down at the U.S. Special Operations Command, who spoke of the unbelievable disarray in Washington and pointed out that there's a war going on. I'm fighting a war, the war on terror, and they better sort this out quickly. Now, I don't think that General Thomas should have been speaking out in that way, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's an indication of his profound distress at the vacuum in Washington that he felt obliged to do so.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will welcome your calls as well. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art. Always free and open to the public.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, leaks from the intelligence services have unleashed spectacular allegations from Democrats.
Russia is the number one enemy of the United States of America. And if members of the administration are essentially conspiring with Russia, that's the definition of treason.
Actually, it isn't. Hear the right definition on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. Maine Public is seeking an experienced human resources professional to lead all aspects of our HR functions for our statewide public broadcasting organization. We're looking for an HR director who's passionate about the work and the mission of public broadcasting and has deep experience in all aspects of employee and labor relations, benefit sourcing, performance management, and HR compliance. If you or someone you know has the experience and enthusiasm that would complement Maine Public's dynamic and talented workforce, there's more information and details on how to apply on our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Diplomacy and International Relations under the Trump Administration. With me in studio, Barbara Elias Klenner. She's an assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College. And Larry Pope is also with us. He's a former ambassador, and he retired from the U.S. Foreign Service after 31 years. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Dr. Peter Wilk. He's a board member of both the National and Maine Physicians for Social Responsibility, which works to address the threats to human health posed by climate change and nuclear weapons. He practices psychiatry in Portland. Peter, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thanks so much for patching me in. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound fine. So late last month, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved their famous doomsday clock to 2.5 minutes to midnight. Can you explain what the doomsday clock is and why the movement to 2.5 minutes before midnight is significant?
Sure, glad to. So the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and their doomsday clock has been around for 70 years. It's a simple way for a group of nuclear physicists, national security experts, and other scientists who are on their board to convey their annual assessment of the risk of nuclear war and, more recently, of climate change having a catastrophic outcome, destroying the world as we know it. 2.5 minutes to midnight is as close to their prediction of doomsday as they have set the clock since the height of the Cold War decades ago. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists' decision to move it closer to midnight was based primarily on President Trump's statements as a candidate at that point, and then his first month as president-elect in December. Nothing that he has said or done since his inauguration has been reassuring that would lead to any sense that the clock isn't that close to midnight. I am especially concerned, as are my colleagues, with the implications of President Trump's repeated comments pledging to build new nuclear weapons and to leave others in doubt, as Professor Elias Klenner was saying earlier, to leave others in doubt as to when he would launch them, as if that's a sensible strategy.
So is there...
A quote that... from him that many may have heard, that he intends to greatly strengthen and expand our nuclear capability, and that when asked later what he meant by that, he said, let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass, outlast them all.
And who is them in this case? Are we talking about Russia, North Korea, or?
In that case, he's talking about Russia.
I see. And so is that the primary concern about the sort of...
No, I would say there is, from my perspective, and I'm sure from your other guests and listeners, as much concern about you know, the proliferation of nuclear weapons to new countries to possess them, like North Korea. Still concern about Iran, although the Iran deal, if he agrees to continue it, has stalled their program, and other countries around the world. If we, the United States, takes off on a very aggressive nuclear weapons buildup program, it's inevitable that other countries will follow suit.
Yeah. So are there any chances or opportunities here to head this off or to improve the situation as you see it?
Yeah, there are a couple. And before I get to them, I wanted to actually follow up a bit on a show you had a couple of days ago that Jennifer Rooks was doing, mm-hmm. in exploring how Mainers can manage their anxiety during these difficult times. And I, as a psychiatrist, certainly advocate things mentioned on the show. Spend time with friends and loved ones, get exercise, good diet, practice mindfulness, get plenty of sleep. All that's important. But I also encourage people to take some action to express their positive values. If you just allow all of this really frightening stuff to throw you back into denial or ignoring it or passivity, it only leads to feeling more helpless. So we advocate joining with others to take some positive action to connect you with a sense of purpose and hopefulness about what can be done. So if I may just make two points about opportunities.
Sure.
We have two very thoughtful senators, Collins and King. Both have shown the capacity to stand up to the new Trump administration, and we want to thank them for that. And they will have an opportunity to vote on whether to proceed with what is now estimated to be a $400 billion expenditure over the next 10 years to rebuild all the nuclear weapons that we currently have. They all, it is said by the administration, need to be remodeled. So we need new bombers, new missiles, new nuclear submarines, new warheads for all of these at a huge expense and, again, provoking other countries. There will be opportunities to vote against that, and I hope especially Senator King, who's on the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the Senate, to take a stand against that. There are also one thing that folks are worried about, I would say, and I'll be curious if any listeners call in, is just the whole concept that a single human being, our president, has the authority and the button, essentially the nuclear football, right next to him 24 hours a day for the next 4 years. And is this really a sensible arrangement? And so Senator Markey from Massachusetts and Congressman Liu from California have introduced a resolution that would, if passed, require a declaration of war at least before the president unilaterally initiated nuclear war. That, of course, he could respond on our behalf if we were attacked by nuclear weapons, but that there would be some sense of a limitation on his impulsivity.
Interesting. I'll get the take of our panel on that. But first, we want to thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
Dr.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Dr. Thank Peter you. Wilk is a board member of both the National and Maine Physicians for Social Responsibility. Let me run that by you. We'll start with that, a proposal to add another check, I guess, by requiring a declaration of war, Larry Pope.
I don't know. I'd be cautious about that in the sense of nuclear deterrence requires sometimes prompt action, and the Congress is not famous for that. But perhaps more to the point, what Dr. Wilk reminds us is of the awesome responsibilities that go with being the chief magistrate of our venerable republic. And it's far from clear that the 45th President of the United States understands that. He seemed so much yesterday in his press conference to be still in campaign mode, still talking about whether Hillary Clinton got the questions to before a particular debate, talking about his margin of victory, getting it wrong for that matter. It's time to transition to governing in light of these awesome sort of responsibilities that he has.
All right, let's go to David right here in Portland. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to share, I guess, my opinion on Donald Trump's comments about creating a nuclear arms race. From my opinion, from what we've seen, is there seems to be a bit of collusion between the Trump agenda and Russia's agenda, and that Trump, I don't think, is serious at all about creating a nuclear arms race. I feel like it is just bait for him to not engage in it and create a nuclear arms deal and look like the good guy. I think that it is basically a collusion with Putin to appear as though he's created something good by threatening something bad.
Okay.
I think that's a plausible explanation in terms of what might be his motivation for making those kinds of statements. I also am not entirely sure that the president has made up his mind about what exactly he will do in terms of nuclear weapons, which, again, does raise anxiety for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he is enjoying, having that flexibility, having that power, having that moment. But I also could easily see him adopting the viewpoint that you share, where he can say, well, either way, this comes out well for me in terms of my, in terms of gaining, in terms of domestic politics.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to see international affairs as if it were a naked power transaction between one state and another. When he suggested that he wasn't necessarily bound by the notion that China is China, the one China policy, he was implying that was a bargaining chip that he could use to sort of get the Chinese to perhaps make concessions on trade. It's a fundamental misreading of the world.
Well, and how does the rest of the world look at what's happening here with this administration? Do they see chaos and disorder? And in other words, what sort of clues do they get that can help inform them as to how they approach their foreign policy objectives?
I don't know how to speak for the rest of the world, Keith, but Barbara was suggesting that, that uncertainty isn't always a sensible approach. People need to know what the United States intends to do so that they can adjust to it and so that our power can be effective through the world. It doesn't do us any good to sort of be throwing off casual comments that we may or may not be serious about.
Go ahead.
Just to further that too, I think that we are likely to see, especially in terms of Russia, China, and probably ISIS, are going to take advantage of that uncertainty and that impulsiveness, and they're going to push the boundaries of American alliances, and they're going to push for their own advantage in that. So I know that the president is seeing uncertainty as his move, but that is a move that can be easily manipulated by other actors in the international arena.
How are things different in terms of how the U.S. has treated its allies? We saw the other day that the administration warned NATO that these countries had to pay their fair share, and the U.S. What are we seeing? Any trends in terms of our ally strategies, relationships?
Well, Secretary Mattis in Europe, it was very forceful, and I thought rightly so, in urging our NATO partners to meet the 2% spending on defense that they've committed to over the years to. He has also, however, reasserted our commitment to Article 5, that is, the defense of one state is an attack on one state means an attack on all. So I thought he mixed those two things, and urging our NATO partners to do more, but also reasserting our broad commitment to NATO. I thought he mixed them extremely, extremely well and effectively in his trip in Europe.
Yep. Let's go to Nemo in Steuben. Hi, Nemo.
When President Trump talks about moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he's talking as a realtor. He sees an empty building, and I can see the Trump Tel Aviv going up in short order. That's one thing. The second thing is, as long as there's a Netanyahu wing, there'll never be a two-state solution. So my thought is there has to be a three-state solution with possibly Greenland as a buffer zone between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Right. The third thing is yesterday I heard that Friedman, the presumptive ambassador, was being confirmed. Now, I'm sure that the Jewish men are confirmed at 13 years of age. Isn't this a little late for him to be bar mitzvahed?
Emo, nice job there on all three. yeah. Any thoughts seriously on even on the real estate? Sort of brings up this point that there are these business interests.
We've got a consulate general in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem. It's a nice building, but it's not large enough for an embassy. We'd have to build something there if we were to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But we'd also be breaking with every other country in the world, none of which, with a couple of small exceptions, have their embassies in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem has to be part of the final settlement, has to be part of the overall deal. And if you move your embassy to Jerusalem, you're recognizing Israeli control over the whole city, and you're compromising the ability of the parties to reach a deal.
All right. We'll take another quick break. When we come back, your questions, comments on foreign policy under the Trump administration, the number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
A new political environment and new laws in New England states might play a big role in the future of fossil fuels, renewable energy, and carbon caps. On Next, we'll dig into this story and listen. No, we're not headed to the Swiss Alps, but instead we'll take you to a ski jump mountain in Connecticut. Take the leap with us on Next from the New England News Collaborative.
Join us for Next coming up in about 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio. In most areas of Maine, over the air or on digital cable, you can watch not one but four Maine Public Television channels. In addition to our main channel, we also offer World and Create and our new PBS Kids channel. World explores our world through many of your favorite programs, such as the NewsHour and Nova, at different, perhaps more convenient, times of the day. Create is our how-to channel, from cooking to carpentry to travel and then some. And the new PBS Kids is 24/7 educational, safe kids programming. If you'd like more information about World, Create, or PBS Kids, including how to find them, see your experience member guide. Visit mainpublic.org and click on television, or just call Maine Public Audience Services. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, changes to American policy and diplomacy under the Trump administration. With me in studio, Larry Pope. He's a former ambassador to Chad, political advisor to General Anthony Zinni in Central Command, and charge d'affaires in Tripoli. He served in the Foreign Service for 31 years. Barbara Elias Klenner is assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, where she teaches U.S. foreign policy and national security. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to AJ in Bar Harbor here in a moment. But we haven't talked really about North Korea yet, which usually is on the front burner of U.S. foreign policy and has been making noise of late, Larry Pope. President Trump hasn't said much relative to North Korea as compared to some other foreign policy areas. Mm-hmm. What's his take here, do you think?
He did discuss North Korea at Mar-a-Lago, where in the presence of the guests down there with the Japanese Prime Minister, Prime Minister Abe, which was I was always taught that you had to go into a secure conference room in order to discuss that sort of thing. Within the next, 4 or 5 years on current trends, North Korea will have an intercontinental missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead that will reach the United States. Now, if that isn't a pressing sort of threat to the United States, I don't know what is. The problem is we don't really have an answer to the problem, to that threat. The Chinese have been unwilling to pressure the North Koreans sufficiently to get them to stop that program.
But the Chinese have basically said, hey, go talk to them about this.
They have. They've been unwilling to use the enormous potential influence that they have in order to restrain that program. Security Council sanctions, more and more draconian, haven't had the desired effect. Just the other day, they carried out an assassination of a half-brother of the North Korean leader in Malaysia. So this is a regime which really does present a threat to the United States, and it's an indication of the fact that we don't live in a world in which which we can allow to sort of go forward and hope for the best. It's a world that continues to require American leadership of a decided and determined kind.
Yeah, and North Korea is difficult because it's hard to understand, I guess, sometimes what the motivations are there.
Sure. I mean, I think that the North Koreans, I mean, the primarily, you know, they use the threat of nuclear activity abroad as a way of, you know, gaining strength at home domestically. But I also think that in terms of the China question, that North Korea is a bargaining chip for China to use against mm-hmm. us. And mm-hmm. I think that that's something mm-hmm. that we will probably see mm-hmm. moving forward mm-hmm. in terms of U.S.-China relations, is that, again, President Trump is always talking about deals and making deals. Well, I think China also wants to potentially make a deal and is going to hold North Korea as a big bargaining chip against us.
This is one where we need allies. We need strong allies in the Security Council and around the world in order to restrain North Korea, that's going to require more than the art of the bilateral deal.
Let's go to AJ in Bar Harbor. Hi, AJ. Welcome to the program.
Thank you all. I think one of the subtexts I hear from both of your guests is that there is method to Trump's madness, and I think we have to seriously confront that there is
that. AJ, I'm sorry, your cell is fading out. I heard you say a few words there.
There's not method to Trump's madness, but madness to Trump's madness.
Yeah, this issue of his, you know, stability or mental illness, this has come up. But is what does that then say when we're having that discussion here in the U.S. to other countries?
Well, from my perspective, I've thought about this a bit, and I see him using foreign policy, national security as a way. The method I think that he's using is that he's using it as a way to gain domestic an advantage domestically. Mm-hmm. That essentially what he's doing is he's using foreign policy to appeal to his base, to appeal to people who voted for him. He's fulfilling his campaign promises. And you can say, look, I tried to do all of these things that I promised you I would do. I am going to come in and I'm going to do what I say. You know, he's this very strong-willed individual. Now, that's something that's separate from, are these things actually making us more secure in terms of U.S. national security? That's a separate question. So I do think there's a method to his madness. I think that his focus is his domestic audience mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. securing, mm-hmm. you know, the reelection in terms of getting those votes again.
Let's go to Maria in Augusta. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I'm going to try to be very brief. The one other thing that Trump is addressing foreign relations, here is the problem. We have thousands, maybe even more than that, of Americans that work in the U.S. Embassy, work with the military, or contractors, or other representative of the government everywhere. And we could not do our job overseas without local supporting us, including those seven countries that he wants to disrupt. So it just can't. I worked in the embassy for 3 years in Korea, and I can tell mm-hmm. you we would not have been able to do anything without the local that we had, mm-hmm. the professional locals that we had in the embassies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one thing. The other thing is, looking at long term, I heard somebody, you know, commenting about not giving a nuclear button to just the president. But one of the things that we need to look at, that when it comes to foreign policy, this is one nation, and we should be more connected as far as Republican, Democrat. We can't change every 4 to 8 years and totally disrupt the whole world by doing this. I mean, it should be a national idea that you the foreign policy is agreed on before things get out of control, using nuclear weapon or what else. So I think that would be a starting point to make things better.
All right, Maria, thank you very much. Appreciate it. She had, her first point was also interesting, which is, you know, he has alienated certain constituencies that he needs to carry out, including the intelligence agency and, as Maria said, the staffers and all these folks that he needs to be able to carry out foreign policy.
Yes, I was suggesting before that we have institutions. We have a foreign ministry. We call it the State Department. We have a what used to be called the Secretary of War, the War Department, which is we now call the Defense Department. These are huge institutions. We have a wonderful professional military. They all require direction. They require leadership. Otherwise, they're rudderless, and the airplane is flying in a direction we really don't know. We can't determine. So it is critical. We had the old expression, you know, politics stops at the water's edge, right? That's an antiquated notion for foreign policy. The idea was that we want to be careful not to compromise, not to argue in public too much, Republicans and Democrats, about our purposes overseas, because our national security ought to unite all of us. And that's the caller was giving voice to that. Well, that's gone. That's gone, and it is too bad.
Well, I also think, too, one of the many reasons why the executive order on immigration was so controversial is that Iraq was on that list. Afghanistan was not, but Iraq was on that list. And you're talking about a critical partner in the fight against the Islamic State at this point. I mean, literally, the United States has individuals, you know, on the ground fighting alongside Iraqis. Absolutely. And so we're trying to ask them to trust us and our guidance in terms of countering this terrorist threat, and yet we're saying, but you're not, we don't trust you enough to come to our country under any circumstances, even if you have a legal visa. It's a very contradictory message that I think does a lot of harm to those critical partnerships on the ground that are actually protecting U.S. national security.
And even this larger group of the bigger effect of sort of lumping all Muslims, or, you know, suggesting through language that that Muslims, you know, equate to terrorism in some way. And they've tried to back off this and say, no, it's not a Muslim ban, and that's not what we meant. But sort of the messaging has already been sent out there, which makes it more difficult.
I'm going to go back to something that Barbara said, which is that he seems to be motivated by what plays domestically, not by what is in the national interest. That's really frightening if that continues to be the case. Yesterday, he attacked the press. He spent most of his press conference denouncing fake news in the leading newspapers of the country. So he's looking for an enemy in order to sort of mobilize his base. Well, the press isn't an ideal enemy. It's an enemy that can be, and a lot of people, you know, he can, at his rallies, he can point to the press and try to sort of incite violence against them. But what would work better in terms of his purposes would be some sort of external enemy. And he's identified Islam in talking about ISIS and the Islamic State as that enemy. So as we go forward, and there are people in his administration who really want some sort of a glorious little war that involves Muslims, that would serve his purposes extremely well to unite the country behind an external enemy.
And I would also add to that ISIS itself also similarly would benefit tremendously from an external enemy, that it can also justify its existence by saying, well, we are protecting Muslims against this existential threat, i.e. this nuclear-armed United States that's coming after us, that has declared that it hates it, Muslims, that sort of thing. So then you have this situation go from bad to really, really terrible.
Exactly. As ISIS and people in the Trump administration agree that it should be a war between Islam, which is a quarter of the world's population, and the West. So they have a real objective agreement about that.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks a lot.
Not the most optimistic. Sorry.
No.
Barbara Elias Klenner is assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Larry Pope, former ambassador to Chad, political advisor to General Anthony Zinni in Central Command, and Charles Defer in Tripoli. He's the author of The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy, two cheers for striped pants. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and a link to our archives by visiting mainecalling.net. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.